Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. I'll be joined on today's show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Mike Murphy from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We will be discussing CRFB's new initiative, Fix Us, as well as a new report on healthcare spending in 2018, an update on the fiscal year 2020 budget process, and other fiscal policy news from the Hill. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that the House could begin voting this week on fiscal year 2020 spending bills after a weekend of intense negotiating. Lawmakers are scrambling to complete a deal before the latest deadline is reached, which is December 20th. The goal is to take the bills in the form of several packages instead of one massive omnibus measure that would total nearly $1.4 trillion. At present, there's still no final deal, but appropriators are beginning to sound optimistic, just like senior appropriators are optimistic that they're narrowing the gaps on border wall funding, which has held up a spending deal for months. But again, there's no deal yet. The House Ways and Means Committee plans to try to make good on a key campaign promise of freshman Democrats, rolling back the 2017 GOP tax law's $10,000 cap on state and local tax deductions, also known as SALT. The panel plans to mark up draft legislation this week. The legislation is unlikely to get support from Senate Republicans, which would be necessary to become law. Up next, I'll be joined in the show by Concord Coalition's Bob Bixby and CRFB's Mike Murphy. We'll be discussing CRFB's new initiative, Fix Us. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Mike Murphy from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Bob, you know well, he's a regular contributor, and Mike is Chief of Staff and Director of Strategic Initiatives for CRFB, where he manages policy research and analysis on a variety of topics related to fiscal policy and the federal budget, as well as coordinating a wide array of projects related to advancing CRFB's policy-related initiatives. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Mike.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you, Chase. Good to be here.
Happy to have you both on the show, and we're going to talk a little bit about one of those initiatives that CRFB is working on during the segment today. It's called Fix Us. And before we get too far down this path, Mike, why don't you give a quick summary for our listeners about what Fix Us is and what you're trying to do with it?
Well, thank you, Chase, again for having me. So let me start by giving the kind of, before even what Fix Us is, let me tell you about its inspiration and why we've started something called Fix Us. So like the Concord Coalition, the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, for years has been advocating for fiscal responsibility in D.C. And our trillion-dollar plus annual deficits we're about to see, our permanent trillion-dollar deficits that we're about to see, are obviously indicative that we are far from solving this challenge. And so over the course of the last few years, while we still, as you at the Concord Coalition are going to continue to advocate to address our deficit and debt challenges, we've come to the recognition that failure to address those problems is actually just indicative of much more fundamental, deeper problems within our system of government. Our inability to solve problems on a range of issues. You know, we're growing, it seems to be growing more and more divided by the day, and that until we address and better understand what some of those root drivers are of our division and polarization in this country, that we believe sustainable policy solutions to the debt and a range of other issues are essentially going to remain elusive. So that's the inspiration for Fix Us. And so out of the committee, we started this effort called Fix Us about a year ago. We soft launched it. And its purpose is to help better understand, bring attention to, and help build a community of those over time that want to try and do something about addressing what the drivers of those divisions are in our country. And so it's admittedly an incredibly ambitious undertaking, and I can talk more in detail, Chase, about some of the specific things we're doing under this for sure. But that's kind of the top-level sort of macro inspiration and purpose of what we're trying to do with Fix Us.
Yeah, I do want to get into the details of what you're doing, but before that, I want to take a step back and pick up on a couple things you mentioned. You talked about, and this is a term that just sort of struck me, the fact that we have permanent trillion-dollar deficits projected in the future. And we don't have to talk about that right now, but that really hit me for some reason this morning. Maybe it's because I'm a new dad and I'm thinking, wow, the future might be a little bleak for him. We should probably act on this. And that brings me to what I wanted to ask, and that is, are you saying organizations like Concord, for instance, should give up on the task of achieving fiscal responsibility, or can these things be done in tandem?
Well, first off, congrats on being a new dad, Chase.
Thanks.
And for your contribution to helping address our demographic challenges.
Well, you know, I'm trying to help Social Security out as much as I can.
That's right. Just a couple things, and I guess in response to that. First off, I mean, just the permanent trillion-dollar deficit is just the fact is obviously is kind of mind-blowing. It kind of resonates with folks. It's just is alarming, to say the least. And I think it is a point just worth emphasizing for folks to kind of better understand the magnitude of where we are. Now, to answer your other question, absolutely not does it mean to giving up on addressing our debt challenge. I mean, I think that, as you guys would certainly well attest, at this moment where people are, in some cases, questioning how important it is to address our debt challenge, right, whether or not, you know, there's obviously those making arguments about whether in given that we have low interest rates, this challenge of our debt may not actually be a big problem. It is more important than ever, right, that I think groups like ourselves are out there talking about this challenge and educating people on it. But at the same time, we believe that over time, it's incumbent to try to understand what some of those forces are that are pulling us apart, because there's a lot of actually groups already that are trying to do work to try and address some of the incentives that are driving polarization. And if we can do something as part of our organization to try and bring more attention to those and ultimately maybe get some things done that changes those incentives, we just think it is important to over time create an environment where actually addressing this could become more likely.
You mentioned that there are other groups that are looking at the issues driving our polarization and division, and what you hope to achieve with Fix Us is to bring attention to those issues and possible solutions. So if that's the case, what are the drivers of the polarization and division that you are trying to educate the public on? So what do you view from the Fix Us lens as those root causes?
So taking a step back for a second from that, too, over the last year and change, one of the things we've been doing with Fix Us, as we've soft launched this and begin to more publicly launch it and rolling it out over the course of the next year, one of the things we've been doing is our own sort of research analysis, not just on the drivers of it, but what the existing organizations are that are working on it. We've basically been doing a ton of private convenings and trying to bring together sort of thought leaders and leaders of groups that are kind of working on this to try and understand what people think are driving this. And here's the bottom line on what the root drivers are is we don't know. But saying that, obviously we have some sense of the things that are driving our divides based on our preliminary research, and I'll talk about a few of them. One is we certainly believe that there are, over time there's been structural incentives built up within our political institutions and our electoral systems that are certainly contributing to a polarized environment as well as an environment of mounting sort of distrust between the public and elected leaders. And these range from things that Chase and Bob, you guys know about, but ranging from things such as how we gerrymander our congressional districts that in ways that can incentivize people to be more partisan and sorted into their sort of ideological camps. It has to do with how our primary systems and elections are set up, which in many ways they, you know, because primaries have low turnout, they tend to turn out the most most partisan sort of voices, the stunt can lead to more partisan outcomes when it comes to candidates or a primary system. Certainly our money in politics and the amount of money that's flooding the system has incentives that are driving some of our polarization here, as well as sort of contributing to a mounting sense of distrust. So the point here is that in one bucket, there's a range of institutional, electoral, structural issues that are certainly contributing, we believe, to some of our divide that we want to try and bring attention to. A second bucket is we believe that there is, and literature and studies would suggest this is the case, there's a range of economic trends and factors over time that are contributing to rising polarization. This includes sort of obviously global trends. I mean, polarization is not a issue that's isolated to the United States. There's growing polarization in Europe and other countries as well. The globalization and some of the effects of globalization and how it's contributed to disparities, both in income and in urban versus rural disparities, is certainly contributing to some unrest and polarization, we believe, in this country as well. So there's a range of economic trends, we believe. And then there's a range of other cultural and societal trends and factors that that people talk about as driving our divides that don't lend themselves towards easy solutions. This ranges from the changing nature of our media environment and proliferation of social media and what that's doing to potentially drive some of our more tribal sort of political dialogue, as well as other, you know, trends in terms of declining social capital and the declining influence of local civic institutions that sort of traditionally would bind local communities together. This certainly seems to be another factor here. So that is all to say, Chase, that we don't have the answers, right, what the root causes are here. There's a lot of people that put forward views on them. That's just a kind of survey of some of the ideas we expect that we'll be talking about. But one of the things we are going to do is try to do some research and bring some attention to those as part of this effort.
And I want to bring Bob into the conversation, but before I do, I had one just general question. You mentioned that Fix Us doesn't have the answers, at least right now. I know you talked about putting research out there and publications. Is the goal here to come to solutions on a lot of these issues, or driving public education and hopefully getting others to propose solutions?
A little bit of both is the answer. So the sort of the three-part approach of activities and things that we're doing for Fix Us is essentially in one piece is it's research and public education, right? So is issuing reports, analysis that will kind of educate folks on the myriad of root causes of what's driving us apart, as well as some events and different tactics like that to try and draw attention to these issues, et cetera. The second bucket is that, you know, one of our theories of change here is that the traditional groups and efforts are doing amazing work that are focused on democracy reform-related issues are largely unknown. They're doing great work, but they're a relatively small community, and our theory of change is that there needs to be a bigger community of folks that are talking about these issues, bringing attention to them. And so we're coming at it from a different perspective as it pertains to the budget, but we're trying to build networks, okay, and alliances of different groups. So that's a second bucket of activity, is sort of mobilizing and building a bigger network of folks that want to get educated on these things. We host a recurring monthly breakfast where we bring together a bunch of the different democracy groups at some of our network to try and build alliances. And another thing we're doing is we're trying to build some networks and alliances with say, other what we call issue groups, so folks that focus on the climate or immigration or infrastructure or education, who are all confronting this issue of polarization and see if we can build some networks that want to become more educated and engaged on this. So that's a, sort of a second bucket of activity. But then the third bucket of activity kind of relates most directly to your question, Chase, which is that over time, what we want to do is try to engage in a bottom-up sort of citizen-guided process that can try to generate both sort of like the values and broader values and aspirations that can unite people across their divide, as well as some ideas on solutions. So one of the things that we've been doing over the course of the last year and change, I think I referred to earlier, has been a roadshow effort where, you know, this is modeled after very successful models we've done, and certainly very similar to the models that the Concord Coalition does as well, where we've been going out and educating people on the budget issue, but what we've done is we've started to educate people on the budget issue as well as these broader trends. And we've been doing this over the last year, and we've had about, I think, like 60 or 70-something events. We've done these over the last year, and it's been a good effort to start to kind of generate our line of thinking on this with different audiences. I say that because over the next year, we're transitioning that effort to try and be more solutions development oriented. We're figuring out exactly how we're going to do it and the different models that we might deploy. But through, you know, exercises and polling and other methods, we're going to start to engage audiences to help us generate what some solutions might be to this over the course of the next year, and issue a roadmap to see how we can deal with this. So the answer is yes. Over time, yes, through a sort of bottom-up process.
And Bob, I know I mentioned I want to bring you in the conversation, but it's time to remind our listeners who we're talking to and what we're talking about. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, as well as Chief of Staff and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, Mike Murphy, and we're discussing CRFB's new initiative, Fix Us. Take it away, Bob.
Okay, Chase, thanks. I think we should mention, too, the play on words here, that Fix Us is not the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, asking for help about their internal problems. It's Fix U.S. That's me. Fix Us is Fix U.S. And Mike, as I hear you describe it, it sounds like an almost as daunting, or perhaps more daunting, challenge than the fiscal challenge, because there truly are a lot of different forces. You can identify the end result of all these things, which is increased polarization, almost dysfunctional. I mean, when I can remember 20 some almost 30 years ago when the Concord Coalition started, we thought things were bad then, and of course they were a heck of a lot better than they are now, because you had, I just think, a better dialogue between the parties, and an understanding that at the end of the day, you had to have some sort of compromise to move policy objectives forward. And we're having a much more polarized and kind of an unreasonable, unflinching debate about things. And it's awfully hard to unwind that. But I wanted to, you know, pick on up on something that I know we've talked about. I've been to some of the Fix Us meetings, mm-hmm. some of the, you know, you've convened folks from other organizations just to check ideas and do some outreach. And, you know, one of the things that came up, struck me at those meetings, is that we've all seemed to experience in our own spheres that when you go and do reach out to people, normal people, through our budget exercise or things that CRFB does or that other groups do, on a micro level, people don't seem that polarized at all. They do seem to be able to talk to one another across the table and work things out and understand that there's some sort of spirit of compromise. It is kind of at a higher level where the locked-in polarization is. Is that, am I getting that right, or have you heard that from others?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that you said it well in terms of the exercises you do, things that we've done too, and this has certainly been indicative throughout this roadshow effort too, is that you go out and talk to folks, and people at the local level, they're not as polarized as sort of the national narratives would suggest. They don't understand, like, what's going on in Washington. They just kind of, like, shrug it off and go, I mean, this is just crazy, like, what's going on in D.C.? And I think they're exhausted is the word that I kind of like that resonates with me. One of the groups that we're partnering with for Fix Us is a group called More in Common. And Bob, they've been at some of the convenings that you're and helped us host a couple of the convenings that you came to. We brought together some of these other issue groups, and More in Common issued this report. It was a fantastic report about a year ago called Hidden Tribes, where they're trying to analyze portions of the electorate And they what they identified through that, some very innovative sort of polling research methods, is they identified, I think it's over 60 to 70% of what they would identify as they called the exhausted majority, right? Is based on sort of the way they view issues, the way their values are, and the way they interact with others, is this exhausted majority that is not on the extremes, that is more prone to wanting to get things done. And again, I just emphasize the word exhausted, because they want to tune out. They don't feel represented by the extremes that sort of dominate our politics. So I think that's true. What I would say, though, also, Bob, is I think that while most of the folks that we talk to would suggest that it's not as polarized as national average would suggest, we know we're not necessarily talking to like a representative sample of the public, right? I mean, I think that in a lot of cases, you know, to put it a different way, some of the folks that will come and show up for a talk that we might give on the budget, it might not be representative. And so we're trying to figure out how we engage with some different audiences to try and see if we can test some of these assumptions too. But I'll tell you, one of the things that was, I don't know if you, if either of you happen to catch this in the last couple of months, it was a fascinating experiment done in Dallas. It was called the America in One Room experiment. Have either of you heard about this?
I did see some publicity about it, yeah.
Yeah, so with a very quick summary.
I've been in a hole for a month with my newborn, so no, I didn't.
Yeah, I know. You've been busy and trying to catch up on sleep. But the basically what it was is take some of our kind of budget exercise sort of simulations that groups like us have done, but broaden the issues to other issues and kind of magnify it on steroids. And what I mean by that is it's done out of a gentleman that organized it, named James Fishkin, with some partners. He's out of Stanford, and he does a deliberative polling as his method. But what's different about it is he gets a scientifically representative sample of people in the room, meaning he uses polling methods. And he even told me one time, this needs to be a scientific sample of exactly what the electorate will be made up of. Like, if I need to go and send someone to milk this farmer's cow in Oklahoma, I'm going to do it to get him, right? He, like, wants a scientifically representative sample. And what he did is he got a huge scientific representative sample of America as a whole. You have to get 400-something people to make sure it's statistically significant. And he had them deliberate over the course of 2 days on a range of issues, from healthcare, immigration, et cetera. And what he found was incredible in terms of what deliberating and talking with folks from different perspectives can do to change someone's views on politics and to inspire a more productive political dialogue. By the time that deliberation was over, had like changes of not like 5 or 10%, but like 40 to 50% in their views to kind of more moderate positions. So I guess my point of bringing that up, Bob, is it kind of indicates that in that case, you know, people hold some pretty partisan views amongst the public, but if you can engage them in dialogue with people different from themselves on these issues, they are more moderate and more compromising than the national environment would suggest.
What's the role of facts in that? Because
in
one,
that
one thing
experiment?
I worry about is that people have their own idea about facts. So does a group like that, or I don't know what fish can use, but I mean, when we're having a debate these days over what are facts sometimes, and that affects us on the deficit and budget issues.
That actually was right in line with what I had in the back of my mind, Bob, is the research I've seen and people I've talked to is that fact-checking doesn't work, but the face-to-face engagement can get you somewhere. So I'm curious to hear what you say as well, Mike.
Yeah, so I think what they do in this on these methods, right, in terms of what this experiment did, is that they do, and this is not too different, obviously, from how the Concord Coalition or our organization does some more budget simulation type exercises, is that they had some issue-based sort of experts advisory groups work with them to organize this event, and what they did on, say, for an issue such as on healthcare, they had arguments, like written out competing arguments, panelists, right, that gave the sort of more left-leaning ideological viewpoints on an issue and the right-leaning ideological viewpoints on the issue with facts and things. And then they were vetted by, like, issue-based experts on both sides of the aisle to make sure they were accurate. And so they were grounding the debate in both ideological sort of viewpoints and making sure it was based on facts from an expert sort of panel that blessed it, so to speak. That's not to say that kind of coming into that room, people may have had some different, you know, perspectives on facts, and we're obviously operating on kind of in many ways, a fact-free sort of environment right now. But at least that's how they did it in this discussion. And once you sort of grounded it in some of this fact-based dialogue, it did really change people's opinions. Now, obviously, the big challenge of that experiment, et cetera, and we hosted a conference call for Fix Us with folks around the country to have this gentleman who organized this experiment come on a few weeks ago to talk about it. And the big question for him over and over again was like, "Oh, this is great, but how do you do this to scale?" Right? And Bob, it's like stuff we've talked about all the time on the budget exercise stuff. Like, how do you actually do this to scale? And that's an incredibly hard question. One of the things that that we're talking about with Jim is that he's trying to figure out if you might be able to take that method, not do it on sort of having to do a scientific sample all over the place, but have it be something where you could have anybody kind of step in and get trained to kind of moderate some sessions like that and try to replicate that both online and in person. But to do it successfully, obviously, to scale, it would take a lot of resources. So that's obviously the core challenge.
So we've got a few minutes left before we have to go here, and I'm going to wrap up two questions into one, maybe giving time for Bob to jump in with another question before we have to go as well. But all through this conversation, I've been wondering, you know, and it may be based on the study we just sort of talked about, but what's been the most surprising thing you've learned in putting all this together as you've been forming Fix Us and bringing people into the room to have this dialogue and conversation? So that's one A. One B would be, in looking at the root causes you mentioned earlier on, which one do you think might be the most toxic or entrenched, like the hardest, I guess, to cure?
So, actually, the answer to my question kind of combines those a little bit. You asked me, like, what's most surprising? And as we've done this now over a couple of years, we've started to wade into how we want to approach an initiative like this. The thing that has surprised me is how enormous this problem is. And perhaps it shouldn't have surprised me. You're talking about addressing an issue like polarization. But I was traditionally of the view that that this was largely a structural problem. What I mean by that is that, you know, that I had been familiar with a lot of previous work and a lot of groups that have attempted to address this through issues such as, you know, what money in politics is doing to our system, or the fact that we need to address how we gerrymander our districts, or those sorts of issues. And I was familiar with that. And I think my biggest surprise, as we go out and talk to people on this roadshow, as we've done our own research and begun to do that in convenings, is actually how enormous this challenge is. In terms of, like, if you start to understand the literature here, and it's an abundance of literature out there, that's been surprising too. It's like, wow, there's actually a ton of work that's being done on this that people don't see. Is the enormity of this challenge, and that combined with the amount of work that's already out there, is a surprise. But I think it's a surprise and also an opportunity, because I think so many people aren't aware of that fact. And the other thing that's heartening is they want to be aware of that fact. I mean, everyone that we talk to is just continuously wants to kind of understand, well, what is going on right now? And if we can do anything to kind of bring attention to that, you know, even though this is an incredibly ambitious undertaking, we know we're not solving this ourselves, okay, is we want to try and do our part to try and bring attention to that. The second question you asked is kind of related to that in terms of what all the root causes, what the biggest one is that you don't see an obvious solution. My take on that has to do with the intersection of technology and the media environment, I think, is where I would, at least my gut on that. I could answer that probably in many different ways. But I think if I had to pick one, that's the one that I see out there as such a huge challenge. And we go, and there's been some studies done on this to kind of look at local communities and sort of, you know, ask local communities what they think about broader polarization, and they tend to say, look, Washington's so divided, we've actually in some ways given up on Washington, and we can solve issues locally. We're going to focus our attention on solving issues locally. And in this particular study, the reason, the top reason they gave of why they've kind of lost faith in sort of our national politics is the media environment and social media, right? And they just don't see an obvious solution to that, right, in terms of the trends that are driving that and how you're going to start to change that. Now, of course, there's huge debates going on in the country right now about the role of technology and the changing nature of our social media environment. So, and there's some folks, I think, working on trying to develop if there are some policy solutions there. But I think that's what I would point to as an enormous challenge when it comes to root causes.
I would agree with you, Mike, on that last challenge. I have often thought that it's the media technology. I don't mean, you know, this in a blame the media sense. I mean it in a technology that encourages short, sharp jabs, which we have now, is almost irresistible and runs counter to the kind of deliberative thought process and policy making that we're trying to encourage. So just to wrap up on is there some way to integrate the thoughts that you're working on into the electoral process in terms of making voters more deliberative or bleeding this into candidate debate somehow?
We haven't figured out yet if and how we want to more directly tie it into candidates in the electoral process. But one of the things, you know, that we talk about on this is that, you know, all eyes right now for the next year are on the presidential race. It's enveloping everything. But we actually see that for this purpose on the Fix Us effort as an opportunity, because the point that we're going to make is, you know, this debate's going to go on for the next year. It's going to have an outcome one way or the other. And half the country is going to be pretty pissed off no matter what it is. These underlying issues are going to remain no matter what happens next year. I mean, it's just a fact. And therefore, we think that there's an opportunity to make that point, and people, that seems to resonate with people as they realize that we're not going to address some of these broader trends given the context of this presidential cycle right now. My point is about, well, we don't have the answer on how we're going to directly tie it eventually to the electoral environment. We do think that the electoral environment over the next year presents an opportunity to kind of generate some discussion around these issues.
This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, as well as Mike Murphy, who's Chief of Staff and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We've been discussing one of CRFB's new initiatives, Fix Us.
I just want to give one last plug, if I could. People are interested in this effort, go to our check out on our website. The direct link that gets you there is fixusnow.org, and that'll bring you to the site. You can also text 33777, and it gets people signed up if they want to get engaged directly in this initiative for our organization. So, but thank you, Chase and Bob. Always great to talk with you. And good luck getting some rest, Chase.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show, Mike, and I'd encourage our listeners to take a look at the website as well. After the break, Bob will be back, and we'll be discussing a new report on healthcare spending in 2018, an update on the fiscal year 2020 budget process, and other fiscal policy news from the Hill. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. We're back with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and we're going to have a relatively short segment here covering some topics in pretty short order, starting with a Congressional Budget Office monthly review update, and then we'll roll over to an update on the appropriations process and a possible government shutdown, and end with a recent report by Health Affairs on the 2018 healthcare spending levels. So let's go back to my first topic, Bob. Welcome back to the show. We just ended a segment with you, but I want to jump right in on the CBO monthly budget review. What did it have to say, and is it indicative of any trends?
Well, we've completed 2 months of the new fiscal year, and we have a budget deficit so far, cumulative, of $342 billion. And that's up a little bit from the budget deficit at this point last year. So the deficit is running a little bit higher, which is what the projection is. But you can't really tell any big trends from just the first 2 months of the fiscal year.
But if you were to sort of read the stars on where current projections are and current policy trends are taking us, Are you expecting a higher deficit this year?
Yes, it should be a higher deficit this year. We ended last year at $984 billion, and CBO thinks it's going to be over $1 trillion this year, and certainly there's nothing in the first 2 months of the fiscal year to indicate otherwise.
One could argue that this will roll into our next topic nicely, that we're not even prepared for this fiscal year, given that we don't have any actual appropriations bills finished for it. So let's talk about the fiscal year 2020 budget process. Where are we right now, and what's the likelihood of us seeing another shutdown?
Well, the fiscal year began 2 months ago, and with none of the appropriation bills having passed, and that is still the case. We've been operating under a so-called continuing resolution, which just takes everything at last year's level, freezes it, and allows the government to stay open. And nothing has changed from that. That latest CR runs out on December 20th. And if Congress doesn't pass another CR or some of the appropriations bills, then we will face a shutdown crisis at about the same time that Congress is likely, the House is likely to be taking an impeachment vote. So that could be quite an interesting week before Christmas this year.
Happy holidays all around, it seems. Are there any?
Yeah, well, you know, and what kind of ties it together is, in a way, is that the biggest stumbling block to the appropriations bills is the border wall funding. That was the same issue as caused the shutdown last year because they couldn't agree. And they haven't been able to agree this year, and neither side wants to, you know, they could pass some of the bills and say, well, okay, we're not fighting about these, so let's just get them passed. But both want leverage. So it's like, well, let's, you know, we're not going to pass any bills until we figure out what we're going to do on the border wall, and we're not going to compromise on the border wall. And so right now, I don't think they'll do a shutdown. I think that they'll probably just kick the can into February or something like that.
Actually, you beat me to the punch there, Bob. My next question was going to be, what have been the biggest stumbling blocks for this process, and are they different from what caused the shutdown in the first place? And it sounds like they're really not. So from my view, it's almost like the biggest point of negotiation here is border wall funding, because even if they got everything else hammered out, like the high level spending amounts for discretionary spending, which they've already done, and even if they agreed to where everything is going to go, they still have to pass the legislation. And if they can't agree on border wall funding or a lack thereof, that legislation's not going to go through.
Right. I think they have made some incremental progress beneath the surface. They did agree, as you said, on the amount of spending for each of the individual bills. And what's being argued about now is so-called riders or policy issues that that get attached to some of the bills. They can probably work that out, but border wall funding is going to be tough because, you know, the president wants a fairly large $8 billion or so for border wall funding. It's important for him for his just because he believes in it and because it's part of his policy for a re-election campaign, and the Democrats are quite adamant that they don't want any funding for the border wall, and so here we are. Appropriators would like to compromise, but you know, the White House does not want the Republicans to compromise, and the, you know, so-called Democratic base it does not want the appropriators to compromise with the president. So it's, I wouldn't want to be in their shoes trying to figure this one out.
Well, I don't know what the best analogy is here, the best comparison, but we're talking about discretionary spending levels at almost $1.4 trillion, and what's basically holding up the process is the difference of a $4 or $5 billion spending gap between what the president wants and what Congress seems willing to give him. So, it's a frustrating issue. I know it's an important issue for our nation and our values and our identity, but in terms of the budget process as a whole, it's a really small piece of the puzzle.
It's a matter of the numbers. It's all out of proportion, and it gets back to what we were talking about in the last segment, because you have absolutists. There will be no funding for the wall. There will be, you know, whatever I, $8 billion, whatever I want for the wall. and nobody wants to compromise. So that's been very difficult.
Health Affairs just came out with a report on 2018 spending levels. Give us a quick summary of what that report had to say, and then we can dive a little deeper into it.
Yeah, well, every year the Office of the Chief Actuary at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Studies, which is a federal agency that deals with health care, puts out an annual report, and they publish it in the journal Health Affairs. And they looked at the 2018 numbers, and they look at not just the federal government, but healthcare spending in the United States, so-called national healthcare expenditures. And they found that healthcare spending in the United States grew by 4.6% last year, which was higher than it had been in 2017, so it accelerated a bit. Total spending was $3.65 trillion. That's if you ever wanted to know how much do we spend in the country on healthcare. And interestingly, that fell slightly as a percentage of the economy, because we tend to look at these things as a percentage of GDP. Healthcare spending the last 2 years had been 17.9% of GDP and looked like it would continue to tick upward, but it actually dropped a little bit to 17.7%. And that was a result of the economy actually having a pretty good year in 2018 and healthcare expenditures staying relatively constrained. So I think probably the bottom line was for the report is that the actuaries described healthcare spending as relatively stable in 2018, but that doesn't mean we don't have any problems. There have to be continued efforts to try to keep the healthcare spending on that relatively stable track.
And we've talked about in the past on the show that demographics are a huge driver on all sorts of things with the federal budget, and healthcare is not excluded from that. So setting aside demographics, we've also attributed healthcare spending growth to be caused in part by healthcare cost growth, which this report seems to talk about a little bit. Is this a continuation of an expected trend, or is the stabilization, as it was put, is that a bit surprising right now?
I think the stabilization is a continuation of a surprising trend. How about that? really, healthcare costs have not, aside from the demographic impact, grown by as much as they were projected to. And I think that is probably a validation of some of the efforts that have been taken over the past few years to help control hospital spending, physician reimbursement, some of those core issues. Now, retail drugs, prescription drugs continue to go up. That's a trend that, it was expected and probably needs more attention. But I'd say that, the core healthcare spending, there's a category called personal health spending. And that doesn't include things like administration and taxes. And personal health care spending has remained constant. The growth rate has remained constant at about 4.1% for the last few years. And that's a steady growth rate. It'd be better if we had it down, but it's not the kind of unsustainable growth rate that people have been warning about. So the demographic portion here is significant. I mean, Medicare spending grew by 6.4% last year. And so, the federal government portion of healthcare spending, which is about 28% of all healthcare spending in the U.S., is a part to look at because it is impacted by the demographic challenge.
And real quick before we go, Bob, we talked a bit about some of the breakdowns and divisions in our nation on a lot of key issues in the previous segment. Healthcare really isn't, again, it's not separate from that challenge. But you did mention that there has been some recent efforts to curb cost growth in the healthcare industry, and it has had some success. So is there hope on the horizon that we'll see more reform continuing this trend of helping slow down that cost growth, or are we starting to see divisions get in here and intervene?
Well, I'd like to see those efforts continue. I'd like to see more focus on that, because we in the political debates, we spend most of the time arguing about who's going to pay rather than what are we paying for. And it's those less sexy issues about what are we paying for in terms of quality measures and things that promote efficiency without sacrificing quality that have funny names like bundling and reference pricing and, you know, things that sound very technical, but policy experts think that they have a lot of promise and have, in fact, been working to constrain healthcare per person, per enrollee, per beneficiary, however you measure it. And those are the efforts that we really need to spend a lot more time looking at rather than just the simple question of, is it going to be the government paying for everything? Are we going to put more burden on providers or insurance companies? You know, who writes the check is an important question, but ultimately it's, if we're going to get a hold of this thing, it's what are we reimbursing whoever's writing the check? What are they reimbursing for?
This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. We discussed a new report on healthcare spending in 2018, an update on the fiscal year 2020 budget process, as well as CBO's monthly budget review. Thank you for joining the show once again, Bob.
Okay, thanks, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.